We look back at 2021, year two of COVID, year one of the Biden administration, plus redistricting and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 24th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, we look back at the second year of dealing with the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The good news of 2021, COVID-19 vaccines became widely available, rolled out for adults over the first few months of the year and later for children now as young as 5 years old. The bad news, about half of the Hoosier population hasn't gotten the vaccine, which has helped lead to surges of the virus throughout the year. The GOP-led Indiana legislature's response to the virus this year has focused largely on restricting public health officials' future ability to respond to health emergencies via restrictions, and now trying to ensure private companies effectively can't force their workers to get the vaccine. How has Indiana handled year two of the COVID-19 pandemic? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, Indiana is one of the worst states in the country for getting its population vaccinated. Will that hurt the state, not just health-wise, but economically and so on? Will that hurt the state in the long run?
Well, I think we've been in this for the long run. We're closing in on 2 years. We're the second variant into this, we're a year into or more into having a vaccine available. I think the time to draw conclusions on this is if not here, it's getting close. I mean, we don't need to look back a decade to see what how the state was hurt. And I mean, hurt how? I mean, certainly the strain on the hospital systems, the National Guard having to go to IU Health to assist in a massive shortage of healthcare workers, nurses, for a variety of reasons. People have left the profession and for understandable reasons for the strain that that's caused. But if you look broader, whether it's the federal government's reaction in pumping trillions of dollars nationwide and certainly billions into Indiana has benefited businesses here, it's benefited the government and tax revenue. Nationally, we're all suffering under inflation. I mean, there's consequences of COVID that aren't just, you know, if you look at the micro level and say, okay, what's the vaccination rate in Cass County, and isn't this horrible? And we're at the time where we can draw conclusions on a vaccine's available, like the governor said, vaccine's available, it's reliable. All of the data points to you're going to be healthier if you get it. You're overwhelmingly unlikely to be hospitalized or seriously, if your health would be seriously compromised, go get the vaccine. At some point, the government, as I've tried to say all along, at some point, if we're just saying, okay, well, what is the hurt to Indiana? It's not for lack of the federal and state governments coordinating, bringing a vaccine to market and encouraging people to get that. We're at the end of that road. We can't shut the economy down again. There's drastic consequences for that. The state was hurt early on. The fact that we were one of the early ones to open and now the economy is doing well and things have seemed to recover and we're ahead on job creation. We're ahead on unemployment rates. We're ahead on revenue. We're ahead in all these other factors, except people going to get vaccinated. And that's got to happen or not. And those individuals will have to live with the consequences of that.
Ann Delaney, realistically, COVID is here. It's going to be here for the foreseeable future. We heard Dr. Jerome Adams say that recently. The governor said that recently. Has the government, Indiana state government, I should say, has Indiana state government done all that it can do to try and get people to get vaccinated?
I think you have mixed messages coming out of the government. Maybe not necessarily from Governor Holcomb, but certainly from the legislature, where they're wading in saying that businesses can't require vaccinations and can't require weekly testing and these kinds of things. I think that that enables people to do things. I mean, for example, with the National Guard only 63% vaccinated, that would never happen in a normal circumstance. The military are supposed to obey orders. If they're told to get vaccinated, they need to be vaccinated. But when you hear Republican officials saying there should not be any mandates and it's up to any individual, that's what sparks that kind of basically a disobeying of orders. And does it hurt Indiana in the long run? I mean, the economics of it aside, I think it hurts the reputation of the state. I think people look at Indiana and say, we're really the Deep South instead of the Midwest. And I think that hurts us. It hurts us in terms of young people, and particularly those that are technologically savvy, want to come and do startups here, want to come and live here. I mean, we don't have the oceans and we don't have the mountains. So what we have or should have is a good quality of life, an easy place to live and raise a family, an affordable place to live and raise a family. And yet we project this image of being like, flat earth. We don't believe in science. We don't believe in the common good. We think that everybody ought to be carrying a gun everywhere. I think that hurts our reputation among young people wanting to come here and settle. And I think that has a long-term, unfortunately, negative impact on the growth and prosperity of the state.
Nikki, a lot of the year, particularly at the legislative level here in Indiana, was spent talking about government powers as it related to what we saw in the first year of the pandemic. The place that they've sort of settled on, and to be fair, we don't quite know all of it because there's still a lawsuit to be settled next year, but do you think Indiana has set itself up well for the future when the next public health threat arises?
I mean, I guess it depends what side you're on, right? Because, I mean, they didn't change any of the powers that the governor has during a public health emergency. You know, a lot of people said a governor shouldn't be able to do A, B, or C, and that everything he did was unconstitutional, but it wasn't, because he was acting under state law that legislators gave him powers on, and they didn't curb those at all. All they did was say, when he's using those powers, we get to come in and maybe trump him, you know? And we're not even sure if that's going to withstand. It's obviously before the Indiana Supreme Court right now.
John Schwanes, speaking of Governor Holcomb on this issue, he's obviously angered some in the far right wing of his party with his stance on, not wanting to tell businesses they can't mandate the vaccine, among other things. But do you think the bulk of Hoosier voters are happy with Governor Holcomb's job performance now in year two of COVID?
I think generally they probably are supportive. Part of that has to do with the economy. The old expression, the KISS method, keep it simple, in politics, with the economy being front and center. You know, you look about it, memories are short. The electorate certainly is short, but I was looking at some old clips the other day, and the State Budget Committee meeting in June of 2020. Now, this was, COVID had already started at that point, but they had a socially distanced State Budget Committee meeting. And at that point, the projection for the biennium was a $3 billion shortfall. $3 billion shortfall. By the end of the biennium, of course, we basically were in a situation where budget architects couldn't figure out how to give away all the money that the state had. Part of that because of the infusion of federal money, but also because of enhanced revenues with state tax collection. So that has been, generally speaking, a boon to the average Hoosier, it seems to me, in terms of employment opportunity, in terms of income. Not everybody, certainly not everybody. Some people are still hurting, and we need to be cognizant of that. But generally, if people vote with their wallets and their pocketbooks, I think that does bode well for the governor. But in terms of the question, are we set up for the next pandemic? I would say from a public health standpoint, no. And not just because of the question over the gubernatorial powers, but it went beyond that this past session in 2021, where you had at the local, at the city, municipal, and county level, that now you have elected officials, whether that's a town council or board or commissioners, can overrule the professionals, the health professionals in those jurisdictions. If, the local health department says we need to shut down, well, then the commissioners can come in and say, not so fast. So it goes, this is more than just the issue that's played out on the state level. This actually has implications, certainly at the city and county level as well.
All right. Well, 2021 was the first year of new President Joe Biden's administration after he defeated former President Donald Trump. Biden has also had a Congress fully run by Democrats who eked out the slimmest of margins to control the Senate after runoff elections in Georgia. Biden and the Democratic Congress delivered another COVID-19 relief package early in the year, sending billions out to state and local governments and the private sector and more stimulus payments to millions of Americans. They also recently approved a massive infrastructure bill that will send $9 billion to Indiana alone over the next few years. But despite election promises from Biden and Democrats, they've failed to deliver a voting rights bill, immigration reform, and are now struggling to pass a larger spending bill, the Build Back Better plan. And Delaney, did President Biden overpromise in the campaign?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, he's proposed exactly what he said he would propose. The problem is, of course, that you have a Senate where the filibuster is still alive and well, and the Republicans are not interested in the Voting Rights Act. I mean, they're interested in suppressing the vote, for example. I mean, they're doing everything they can to restrict the right to vote and to make it more difficult for people to vote. So they're not going to vote. They're not going to, unless we scrap the filibuster, which frankly I think is long overdue, they're not going to pass anything meaningful that will help people vote and help people with the opportunity to participate in the democracy. They're just not interested in it. So we need a larger margin or getting rid of the filibuster to come through with that. But President Biden has done exactly what he proposed to the voters that he'd do. The problem is the Republicans are not interested in participating and being in part of a bipartisan government. And that's unfortunate, but it's reality.
Mike O'Brien, you buying that?
Well, I agree with part of it. Mitch Daniels once said big change requires big majorities, and Democrats don't have them. And in the House where they do, they have members who are from marginal districts who know that if they go along with that program that they're putting their reelection at risk. And what's sizing up to be, you know, if you believe the elections this year, whether it was the Virginia gubernatorial race or other special elections, the Democrats are sizing up for a pretty big loss next year in the midterms. You know, and Joe Biden, I might misquote him, but I think he said that as far as the Senate Democratic Caucus is concerned, when there's 50 members, every single one of them is the president and can hold that caucus hostage, and whether it's Joe Manchin or others who have seen that proposal and again are thinking back home with a constituency that isn't for it, aren't go along with it, and Democrats themselves are forcing that package to be smaller and smaller without Republicans' help.
John Schwanes, when it comes to sort of evaluating Biden's first year in office, how much is going to ultimately rest on whether or not that larger spending bill, whether it's before the end of the year, and we're taping this a little ahead of the end of the year, but before the end of the year or just after it, how much will rest on whether or not that larger spending bill gets passed?
I think it's important, not just because of the substance of the legislation in terms of the dollars that would be allocated, but also it has to do, I think, with the perception of the ability of the occupant of the Oval Office. Is this somebody who can deliver? Is this somebody who can work with Congress? I mean, that was Joe Biden's biggest selling card, perhaps, was his familiarity with the inner workings of the Senate and the House and his ability through his personal connections and his dedication to consensus building and compromise to get people to coalesce around an agenda. The failure to do that certainly hurts him in a real tangible sense in terms of the allocation of dollars and policy implementation, but also that sense of just not being able to get things done, it seems to me, would haunt him as well. That would be damaging, I think.
All right. Well, this year also marked a once-in-a-decade political event, the redrawing of congressional and state legislative district lines following the decennial census. The Indiana Republican supermajorities at the State House used the latest round of redistricting to help ensure they will likely remain in the supermajority for the coming decade. The congressional map wasn't dramatically changed from a political standpoint. The current 7 GOP districts and 2 Democratic ones should remain that way, though the state's only really competitive district is much less so. The Indiana House maps are similar, largely maintaining the status quo, though Republicans could potentially lose a couple seats. Senate Republicans, however, sought to tighten their grip on the supermajority, likely gaining a couple seats. Overall, independent analyses of the maps project that out of 159 total districts across the 3 maps, only 11 will likely be competitive in the near future.
John Schwanes, other than the process itself getting delayed from the regular session in April all the way till August and September, despite all the extra attention on redistricting this year, did it play out pretty much exactly the way you would have expected?
I would say so. And I think that we all, well, I won't say all of us said as much, but I certainly felt that that would be the outcome. And again, it's not as if somebody is breaking the rules or even bending the rules. The rules may be the problem for those who find this kind of gerrymandering to be upsetting, because people are basically pushing those rules as far as they can without incurring the kind of a successful challenge. And several states, we're seeing that around the country right now unfold. But generally speaking, you know, courts have not been real amenable lately to stepping on the toes of lawmakers who in most states have the authority and the ability enshrined in their constitutions to determine their boundaries. So, you know, lawmakers on the Republican side even hired, we talked on the show a few months back, I forget the billable hours, it was Ann Delaney kind of money on an hourly rate to hire some DC firms to make sure that nobody crossed that line, but to push right up against it. So it's not a surprising outcome. It may be a disappointing outcome, but those are two different things.
Nikki Kelly, to that end, did anything about this process, other than the timing of it, did anything about this process stand out as surprising to you?
No, I mean, it seemed very similar to what I saw the last two I've covered. I do think maybe the House Republicans were a little more amenable to taking suggestions from the public and actually incorporating them. The Senate sort of was kind of going for the throat, I think I've said before. In the end, you know, we're going to see status quo. Both sides will likely keep their supermajorities in the House and Senate. And there's, you know, but that, you know, that supermajority level doesn't match, you know, election results that we've seen in like governor's races and, you know, U.S. Senate races, which are more in the 56-58% range for Republican votes. So they definitely use it to their full advantage. And so far, we haven't seen anyone challenge them. So,
Ann Delaney, given the stat I cited in the piece, which is that some independent analyses said only 11 out of 159 districts across the three maps are likely to be competitive in the near future, is it going to be hard to get voters excited for state house races for the next few years at least?
Well, that's by design, Brandon. I mean, when I talked about suppressing the vote, that's what this is all about. I mean, when you don't have competitive districts, you don't have democracy at work. And the Republicans cracked and packed those districts to the best. When you say pushing up against, the Supreme Court has basically said they're not going to deal with gerrymandering. So they did whatever they could do. I mean, Fort Wayne's a perfect example of what they did, splitting that up into four different districts. They've done it deliberately. And does it depress democracy? It absolutely does. And it's designed to do that. Republicans don't want people to vote, and they want to make it as difficult as possible for them to do their constitutional duty and vote. And I think that that is a really, it's not only selfish, it is undermining government and undermining democracy. And I think it's really unfortunate.
Mike O'Brien, we've already seen this play out over the last decade as Republicans gained supermajorities at the state house. But how much more are we going to see policymaking shift as the competitive elections are in primaries and not general elections?
You'll continue to see what you've seen, and you may not like it, and count me among the people who don't like it, but Indiana Democrats are not competitive in Indiana. This is to ignore that and conclude that the redistricting process, because it didn't result in a competitive electorate, is a failure. It ignores basic math. Democrats in large parts of the state are
you're talking about one election for governor.
They are a third place party. That is a huge
in one election for governor, Mike.
The state is so conservative. The Indiana Republican Party isn't even conservative for some of the people in the in this state anymore. That is a big problem.
It's not true.
I appreciate that Michael Schmuel is out and he's going out state. He's getting out of the urban cores. He's re-engaging voters in parts of the state that they haven't talked to in a century.
Well, you guys don't talk to him either.
We represent 88% of them. 88% of local elected officials are Republicans. You're losing statewide elections by 20 or 30 points. This is a math problem. You cannot win without changing your policies and not bringing a Washington D.C. Democratic Party agenda to Indiana. And that's it.
You're wrong.
All right. You're absolutely
wrong.
This is a math problem, and you guys suck at it.
Let's move on.
The beginning of 2021 was marred by an attempted insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as thousands of people sought to stop Congress from certifying the election for President Joe Biden.
More than 600 people are facing charges related to the January 6th riot investigation, with several dozen having pleaded guilty. Most are facing low-level misdemeanor charges. There's also an ongoing investigation by the U.S. House, which is trying to get to the heart of the insurrection and its causes. Meanwhile, Republican elected officials across the country have spent the year perpetuating the lie that, at least in part, contributed to the riot, that Donald Trump won the election.
Nikki Kelly, has the country learned any lessons from January 6th?
Ooh, I don't know about that. The day it happened, I think everyone sort of kind of came together and was appropriately outraged and realized how serious and dangerous it was. But since then, you know, it seems to me that we've moved into sort of spin and conspiracy theories and that kind of thing. The individuals involved are being held accountable. I think it's a much more complicated picture when you look at, you know, who incited those individuals to be there in the first place.
John Tronis, same question. Have we learned any lessons?
I think it was a reminder how fragile democracy can be. It's a participation sport. And if reasonable people disengage, it creates a vacuum and crazy people step into the void. It also, I think, shows how willing people are to be misled. We live in the age of, this is supposed to be the information age. The 21st century was supposed to be the information age. Thanks to the internet and the democratization of information and news, what is created is basically people able to find support online or on air for any idea, however crazy it might be. And so these days there is no debate. There's too little debate about how to solve problems and the policy differences about how to solve them. Now there's disagreement because of misinformation about even what the problem is or whether there's a problem at all. So it's the lesson learned, I think, is we've got to find a way to become a more a savvier consumer of news and information as a country, or we're in trouble.
It seems to me that we're going to find out if we learned any lessons probably in a couple of years when we have another presidential election. But finally, we like to do this around here. As you look back at 2021, who is your biggest winner in the Hoosier political scene? We'll start with you, Mike O'Brien. Who and why?
Let me give the most unpopular answer on the panel. Todd Rokita. He's turned the attorney general's office, a mundane, largely legal administrative office with a pretty narrow statutory charge, into an effective political weapon on some of the cultural issues of the day.
Ann Delaney, biggest winner.
Oh, I think it's Brian Bosma, because he got out before his party was taken over by the people who think that January 6th was a bunch of tourists going to tour the Capitol.
Nikki Kelly, biggest winner.
You know, I'll go with Northeast Indiana. I think Representative Jim Banks has raised his profile nationally and probably will see some added seniority and clout with that.
Boy, the reporter from Fort Wayne saying Northeast Indiana. That's some homerism there. John Schwanis, quickly, biggest winner.
Try to find something different that hasn't been said. How about private schools? The voucher program continued to expand at great pace. Now most Hoosier middle-class families can go. It's a great expansion over what it was designed to be in 2011.
All right, and then biggest loser of 2021. Ann Delaney, we'll start with you.
I think I'd go with Governor Holcomb. I mean, he's demonstrated no ability to lead. He can't even lead his own party. I mean, how many times have his vetoes been overridden? He just does not rise to the task of being governor of Indiana in an era where there are so many problems.
Mike O'Brien.
I think Marion County Prosecutor Ryan Mears has turned not prosecuting criminals in Indianapolis into a professional sport.
John Schwanis, biggest loser. Biggest loser of 2021.
The executive branch, whether that's a governor, not a particular governor, but governor, or the people who hold executive branch positions further down in the state, yeah. For reasons I mentioned earlier in the show, they're hamstrung in many cases by elected officials, and it seems to be a tipping of the scale.
And Nikki Kelly.
I'm going to agree with John Schwanis on that one. I think that's one I hadn't thought through, and I think it's a good choice.
I love it. All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy. Please get vaccinated if you can. Have a happy holiday and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana year or week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.